This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. Yes, it is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. talking stuff about books. Two authors in particular. Today, in the first half of the program, I'm going to play an interview I recorded earlier today with Pico Iyer about his book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. And in the second half of the program, I'm going to talk with local poet and marriage counselor, Belden Johnson, about his, mostly about his new novel, Fathers and Teachers, but we'll also talk a bit about his 30-year-old book of poems, Snake Blossoms, and maybe some other things he's written and done in the community as well. Pico Iyer is one of those almost ubiquitous names. If you read more than one publication, he appears in places as wide apart as Time magazine, where he was once a regular correspondent, the New York Review of Books, he publishes there quite often, the New Yorker, those are three that come to mind, but there are many magazines, many other newspapers as well. He's also written half a dozen books and a couple of novels. One of his best-known books is called The Global Soul, which appeared about, I think, 2002, where he examines globalization not from an economic or even macro political or social point of view, but just what happens with people who are essentially made up of many different parts of the world. One of the first examples he gives is a Hungarian Jew whose family moved to Canada after World War II, found themselves in Montreal in a French-speaking area. He tried to establish his independence by insisting on speaking English and then went to school in England, then wound up back in Toronto. So he has at least four cultures in him by the time he's 20 or so. And in The Global Soul, Pico Iyer discusses, he talks about airports. There's a wonderful section about airports. He talks about shopping malls around the world and just how different cultures are essentially getting mashed together in ways that could not be predicted and may have very strange results. It's kind of interesting in some ways to look at the 14th Dalai Lama as the probably foremost epitome of this global soul. He's a person from a society that almost entirely kept the outside world out until he was a very young man. Then it was forcefully, his country, Tibet, was forcefully incorporated or reincorporated, depending on how you want to look at it, into its big neighbor, China. He fled to India and has spent much of the rest of his life traveling around the world to promote the cause of his nation, but also a way of looking at the world that most of us didn't even know existed 40, 50 years ago. So I'm not going to say much more about it. I'm just going to play the interview this morning. And in the second half of the program, as I said, I'm going to talk with Belden Johnson.
I think your father first met the Dalai Lama when you were very tiny, just a few years old. He, I believe, went to Dharamsala to see him. He was working on a book about Gandhi. At least that's what you say in your book. And you first met him when you were 17. So you have a long history with this fascinating man.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. My father met him the first year the Dalai Lama came into exile, 1960. We were living in England, but my father went all the way back to India to meet him because my father was a philosopher and was interested in Buddhism. And I think was one of the relatively few people to know that suddenly, for the first time in all these centuries, this great repository of wisdom, the Dalai Lama, was available to the outside world. And one of the interesting things is that, as you say, my father was interested in Gandhi, so he had a long and, I think, fruitful conversation with the Dalai Lama, who was also thinking about Gandhi, especially as he found himself in exile, and thinking about how to lead a non-violent resistance against an occupying power. And at the end of the conversation, sort of like any proud father, my father said, well, you know, Your Holiness, I've got this little three-year-old boy back in Oxford, England, and he's been really interested in the Tibetan situation. He followed on the radio the story of your flight from Tibet. And the Dalai Lama, with his perfect gift for the perfect gesture, found then and there a photograph of himself when he was 5 years old, and he sent it to me through my father. And of course, as a three-year-old, I didn't know exactly who or what the Dalai Lama was, but I always kept that photo on my desk. And so I made that connection when I was a very small boy. And a little later, we moved from England to California, and the photo came with me to California, and it sat on my desk for 30 years. And then one day, one of these forest fires struck up near our house in Santa Barbara and wiped out the house. And I suppose in some ways enforced the meaning of the photograph, which is you can't cling to things. The photograph is just reduced to ash, but the values that it stands for and the possibilities it points to, as long as those are inside yourself, then they're much more lasting. So before I ever met him, I had that interesting experience with the photo, and then I first met him when I was 17 years old visiting Dharamsala.
And that time you weren't quite sure what to make of him.
Yes, I'm embarrassed to say that I barely knew what the Dalai Lama was. Most people in 1974 hadn't heard of the Dalai Lama. And I remember it was a midsummer day when usually there's very strong rain. There was just clouds on that day, very strong clouds. And my father and I took the overnight train from Delhi up to a little town called Pathankot. And then we got into a taxi for 4 hours of zigzagging around the winding curve up into the foothills of the Himalayas. And just really went to the last little house along the road, modest yellow cottage, rang the doorbell and went in to see him. And not many people were calling on the Dalai Lama in 1974. And as you were saying, I was a typical 17-year-old. Really, my dream was to meet Leonard Cohen or Jerry Garcia. I wasn't so interested in philosophers and high rigorous thinkers. But I'll never forget that, you know, instantly he made contact with me, as he does with everyone. And as I sat in his room, it was, as I say, a very heavy mist. So I couldn't see any other house. I couldn't see any sign of human existence. And it really seemed to me as if these two philosophers, my father and the Dalai Lama, were sitting on the top of a mountain talking about reality and emptiness and compassion, all these lofty ideas. And I didn't know in my ignorance that, in fact, the Dalai Lama was already working on an hour-by-hour basis with negotiating with China. But to me, it had this otherworldly quality.
Since then, you've met him many times, and the world has gotten to know him much, much better. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize 20 years ago, and any place he goes, any tickets to see him sell instantly. I guess you found him to be a very complex and very valuable person.
Absolutely, and I think wonderfully unchanged by all of that. And I think one reason the Dalai Lama speaks to the rest of the world so powerfully and so immediately is that if he's stepping into Central Park before 200,000 people, or if he's stepping into Washington to meet our president, he's exactly the same person as would extend his hand to a little five-year-old boy in the street. He's always exactly the same person, even as he's very good about knowing how to adapt his ideas and his talents and personality to the particular situation. But it was interesting, I just recently, as I was completing my book, I found an account that my father had written of after his first meeting with the Dalai Lama in 1960, so 49 years ago. And when I read what the Dalai Lama was saying when he was only 24 years old in 1960, almost word for word what he would say to you or me if he were to meet us tomorrow or the last time that I interviewed him. So there's a remarkable consistency. The whole world is swirling around him, but he remains, I think, the most solid and consistent person I've ever met.
Although you do say that when he first went out into the larger world, he tried to talk Buddhist philosophy in a fairly abstruse way and didn't connect with people too well. Then he realized what he had to talk about was the state of the world, and in particular the state of Tibet.
Yes, he's a great empiricist. I think whenever he travels, he's not traveling just to give something, but also to learn from all these new situations. And one thing he's learning is by watching, seeing what that he says or what that he does makes real contact with people and what isn't so useful. So exactly right. I saw him his first tour in the U.S., which is 1979, and he came to visit Harvard. And he must have thought, well, Harvard is the center of all these great philosophers. So he gave this very, very lofty, rigorous philosophical talk, and I think almost nobody could follow it, and register that. And so if he were to go to Boston today, he would speak in a much more human, down-to-earth, concrete way, because he knows that if he's speaking philosophically in a way that isn't connecting to people, then that time isn't being usefully spent. And as with so much in the Dalai Lama, I think that comes directly out of the Buddha, because the Buddha himself used to speak about skillful means, as he called it, which means that you talk one way when you're talking to a Harvard philosopher, and another way when you're talking to your grandmother, and another way when you're talking to a six-year-old girl. And all those ways come out of the same principles. You're expressing the same thing, but you're finding different ways to express it or appropriate to the situation.
You refer at one point to a scientist of the emotions, Paul Ekman, who says that the Dalai Lama uses his facial muscles more vigorously and with greater precision than anyone he's studied in 40 years. And then you go on to say, every feeling, mirth, sharpness, solicitude, reflectiveness is fully inhabited for a moment and then is gone.
Yes, but in fact, I'm excited because I'm about to do an event with Paul Ekman in San Francisco on April 7th. I've never met him, so I'm looking forward to hearing more, because he, as a scientist, spent a lot of time with the Dalai Lama trying to see, he's actually tried scientifically to measure charisma, or to try to find out how the Dalai Lama remains so calm, and also how he has such an effect on people. But you're absolutely right. I think when you talk him, whether he's talking before a huge crowd or talking privately, one of the things you notice about the Dalai Lama is he's roaring with laughter this moment, and then he's very serious and intense and attentive the next, and then he's speaking in a very everyday manner the next. And there's some sense in which he's not holding on to any of his emotions. He inhabits each one 100%, but doesn't cling to it and doesn't get trapped in it. So somebody tells him a sad story, and he listens so carefully that there are almost tears in his eyes. And then 2 minutes later, there's a different situation, and he's throwing his head back and clapping with laughter.
You divide your book into three parts, which I find very interesting. The first is called In Public, the second In Private, and the third In Practice. Each of them has three chapters. But in a sense, you can't really divide him or anyone in that way, because the section in public is full of references to his private life, the section in private is full of references to his public life, and his practice comes out in both. I'm not quite sure why you decided to, well, I can see why you wanted to divide that, but it's a division that's more formal than real.
Oh, that's wonderfully said. You expressed it perfectly, and you're the first person to say it, and you're absolutely right. And I think one thing I was trying to do was indeed to get that sense of interconnectedness, just as you were describing, because that's such a core part of his philosophy. Exactly as you say, that when he's a politician going to Washington or Brussels, what you're really seeing is the monk. When he's working as a monk and exploring Buddhism, what you really see is the scientist and this rigorous, rational person trying to explore the laws of the mind the way other people would explore laws of nature. And when he's walking into the room right now, he's a human being that we make contact with, but what we're really seeing are the fruits of that philosophical and monastic practice. So exactly, you can't separate them. And I think part of his power has to do with the way that he's woven all these aspects into one another, so that he's a spiritual and temporal leader, but all his work in the temporal world comes out of his spiritual practice. And so you're right that any distinctions you make are artificial, or the ones that I made are artificial ones.
Of the three sections, I found that the one that seemed to pull it all together was the middle one in the third section called The Politician. At least that's the one where I made the most marks, because that is the place where he's had in some ways the most influence, but it's also the most difficult part, because he has to balance. You say at one point he has two constituencies, Tibet and the world, and he has to try to preserve the Tibetan culture, the Tibetan nation, but he also has to, or feels he has to, explain to the world the way to undergo politics, which is not through violence and it's not through aggression. And this gets very complicated.
Yes, and that, exactly. And I think I would just distill it and say that really the way I see it is that he's one of the most clear-sighted, rigorous, impressive human beings I've ever met, who's laying out a very logical and lucid philosophy for thinking more clearly and realistically about the world. But he's living in a fallen and complicated and confused world. So he's a human being in the world who's offering us these great possibilities, but there's no guarantee that we will be able to rise or live up to those possibilities. And so, as I see it, he's done his part of the transaction wonderfully, and he's put all these ideas out there. But whether you and I can implement them and whether the world can wake up to its better nature remains to be seen. So that's why there's not a happy ending in the book. And essentially, I'm presenting a conundrum in some way. Here's this useful ray of light that we can bring to our lives. Are we going to do it? That's up to us.
The Tibetan nation, Tibetan culture as they exist now, are so completely tied up with him. And yet he tries to step back from that. He has tried to make his government more democratic. He said that he doesn't want to be the decision maker. He wants to pass the decisions on to all of the Tibetan people. But the Tibetan people, at least the ones who can actually have some say on the government in exile, consistently refuse that.
Yes, exactly. It's that's the rare place in the world where the leader is trying almost to force democracy on his people, and the people are saying, no, we want autocracy. But you're right. The first thing he did when he came into exile was to draw up a democratic constitution for the Tibetan people for the first time in their history. And he does indeed now. First he had a democratically elected parliament and then democratically elected cabinet, and now there is a democratically elected prime minister. And the Dalai Lama is keen, I think with a view to the future, as you say, to bringing as much responsibility as possible to that prime minister. And he says, and again, it's surprising to some of us to hear it, that in the future he thinks the Dalai Lama shouldn't be the political leader of Tibet, if there is a Dalai Lama, but certainly that church and state should be divided, and that the people of Tibet should have as much power as they can, which really speaks to a Buddhist idea. Even when the Dalai Lama visited China and spent many months with Mao Zedong in 1954, he was very impressed by communism because of the idea of equality. And I think he's a natural democrat and always regards himself as the equal of everyone he meets, whether a fellow head of state or a homeless person. And I think that's a Buddhist idea too. So he's really trying to create a Buddhist democracy.
But he's not at all sure that he's succeeded as a politician. He feels he may have failed, and I think many, especially younger Tibetans, might agree with him.
Yes, and again, it goes back to that conundrum I was stating before, that on paper he's done everything that can be done that's useful and liberating, but how much the world will follow that remains to be seen. And I think he certainly feels, on a human level, the mounting frustration of, as you said, more and more young Tibetans who say who've seen him extend the hand of forbearance and tolerance and nonviolence to the Chinese for 50 years. And so far, it's borne no visible fruits. Even 10 years ago, I remember I was talking to him about it, and he said, well, if you look at it in one way, my policy has been a complete failure. I've achieved nothing at all, and China is just coming down on the Tibetans harder and harder. So I think he understands why many Tibetans are calling out for a more confrontational strategy or policy, but he also knows that in the long run, that will only lead to more suffering for everyone. And I think, you know, his first job probably is protecting the 6 million Tibetans in Tibet. And he knows that if Tibetans or the rest of the world were to goad or provoke or confront China too directly, that would only lead to more suffering and more oppression on the 6 million Tibetans in Tibet.
Before 1950, only a handful of Westerners had actually made it into Tibet, and it was a mythical, magical land, Shangri-La and all that. Since he left, since he went into exile, the Chinese have moved increasingly into Tibet to the point where in a few years they might outnumber the Tibetans. That will destroy Tibetan culture. He's done an amazing job of spreading what was this little isolated country, spreading Tibetan culture worldwide so that they're now Tibetan monasteries on probably every continent. But those Tibetans are losing touch with their homeland, and many of them, I guess, don't even speak Tibetan.
Yes, and indeed in the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, the Tibetans are already a minority, and it's certainly true the last time I was in Lhasa, it looked like Las Vegas. I mean, it's just a big modern Chinese city with huge skyscrapers and shopping malls and broad boulevards, and doesn't bear any resemblance to the Lhasa I saw in 1985. So it's true, exactly as you say, that within Tibet itself, Tibetan culture and Tibetan identity is being really eroded very quickly, at the same time as Tibet around the world is an ever stronger presence. When my parents were growing up, nobody could really dream of seeing a Tibetan or seeing a Tibetan concert or going to a Tibetan temple. And now, as you said, most people in most continents can do that. So Tibet is interesting in the perspective of globalization, because Tibet has gone global and it's become a very successful and thriving part of the global neighborhood, while in Tibet itself, it's moving ever closer to extinction. But it's interesting that I found out in my research that the first words that the Dalai Lama uttered when he entered India in exile in 1959, he turned to his younger brother and he said, "Now we are free," which is an amazing thing to say. He's just lost the country that he was born to rule. He's just lost contact with his people. He's just lost the future he had imagined. And yet, his first words are, "Now we are free." And I think the Dalai Lama's way is always to see everything as opportunity or potential. So instead of going into exile and seeing it as loss or hardship or sadness, he instantly was saying, well, this is a chance to reform Tibet, to bring it in greater contact with the rest of the world, to bring in democracy and science and to learn from the rest of the world in a way that we couldn't before. And he always stresses to this day that insofar as Tibetan culture and Tibetan language and Tibetan philosophy are things you carry inside yourselves, those potentially can last as long as they ever could. And he spent a lot of his early, soon after he came into exile and subsequently, he talked a lot, for example, to Jewish leaders and the Jewish people to set as a precedent for how Judaism kept very strongly alive its cultural integrity and its sense of continuity, even without having a geographical center. So he knows that it's possible to do that.
But do the young Tibetans want to do that?
Well, I think the young Tibetans are probably torn in very human ways we can relate to, which is, on the one hand, like most of us, they want to have a global life, they want to be modern, they want to have access to all the stuff of the West, and probably to live a comfortable life in California or New York or Sydney or somewhere like that. On the other, I think most of them realize that they're sitting on a treasure in Tibetan heritage. And one of the reasons why you or I may suddenly come to life when the Tibetan comes into the room is that he's bringing the vestiges of this distinctive culture and philosophy and heritage. And so I think they realize that they and the people around them would be the losers if they relinquish that that heritage. Many young Tibetans in India, for example, do feel lost because they're Tibetans who've never been to Tibet, and they speak perfect Indian and English, but as you say, they don't speak Tibetan. And so they are going through a transitional phase. But I think the Dalai Lama always stresses that culture really exists at the realm of the invisible. And he often says, well, if we lose Tibetan costumes or certain Tibetan customs that were set, made for a country of 14,000 feet above sea level, no problem. We should lose those as we're living in India or America. But don't let us lose those values of interdependence and compassion and responsibility. As long as you keep those, then the most important part of Tibet is still alive.
Buddhism moved from Tibet into Mongolia, Manchuria, and northern China, and in the Qing dynasty in particular, Tibetan Buddhism had a very strong influence on the Chinese ruling classes, at least. And in recent years, I've noticed a fair number of either real or fake Tibetan monks in many Chinese cities. Do you know anything about that? Is there any chance that Tibetan influence may gradually soften the Chinese?
Oh, I think that's definitely happening. The Dalai Lama says there are now 100,000 Han Chinese people in the People's Republic who are practicing Tibetan Buddhism. And indeed, the last time I was on a plane flying into Lhasa, I'd say 90% of the people on the plane were Chinese, Han Chinese. Many of them were going for job opportunities, and quite a few were going as tourists, but I think quite a few were going for spiritual reasons. They were going to seek out Tibetan Buddhist teachers and Tibetan Buddhist scriptures, and even the central Tibetan Buddhist temple in Lhasa, the Jokang. And I think that makes sense, because you and I have been talking about how in America and Australia and Europe there's more and more interest in Tibetan Buddhism, because people feel that it's answering a need they have in themselves that other traditions aren't fulfilling. And if that's the case for us, I think it would be 10 times more so for the Chinese, because the Han Chinese in the People's Republic have been denied all religion for 60 years. And I think there's something in the human spirit that cries out for just some wisdom or guidance or solace, something of what religion represents. And so as that lost generation in China tries to deal with everyday life and calls, reaches out to spiritual wisdom, I think they're beginning to realize that they actually have within their boundaries now one of the deepest, richest, and most ancient spiritual and philosophical traditions in the world in Tibetan Buddhism. So I think each year we're seeing more and more Chinese reach out to Tibetan culture. And it's a slow process, and the numbers are still small, but it's only going to increase with every passing day, I think.
When you finished this book a year or so ago, it was still possible for Westerners to fly into Lhasa, but now it isn't. The uprising from last year clearly shook the Chinese, although there are some people who would claim that it was provoked by the Chinese deliberately, but it certainly led to them cracking down very hard. And now that the 50th anniversary of the Dalai Lama's exile has just come, no one can get in again. How do you see the current situation?
And I think, no, you're exactly right, that China has just yanked down this black curtain so that nobody in the world is able to know, or to see at least firsthand, what is happening in Tibet. And I think that's why the Dalai Lama has been so outspoken in the last 12 months. I think he was shaken and shocked by what happened last March, and especially, as you say, by the way the Chinese cracked down, and they now have a policy of beating regular Tibetans before they even arrest them. That's why just on March 10th this year, the anniversary of his beginning to come into exile, he said that Tibet is a hell on earth. And I've known him for 34 years, but I've never heard him speak out so strongly and so unqualifiedly as he has in the last 12 months about the horrors that are taking place in Tibet. And he's doing that because he realizes that people can't report from Tibet. Regular visitors like you and me can't go and tell the world. So he has had to really amp up the vigor and the directness with which he tells us that something terrible is taking place there. Whenever he comes to Japan, which is every November, I spend the whole week that he's in Japan traveling by his side from dawn to sunset every day. And so when he was there a few months ago, everywhere he went, whether he was talking to foreign journalists or Japanese politicians or anyone, he always said, the thing he stressed was, please see if you can go into Tibet and just give us an objective account of what is taking place right now there. I don't want to listen to Tibetan propaganda. I don't want to listen to Chinese propaganda. All I want is an objective, realistic, first-hand account of what's happening. He knows it's difficult, but he still realizes that's what's required now. So you're right. I think that's why he's been stressing that this is the darkest period in Tibet's history, precisely because we're not in a position to know what's going on. But every day he is getting reports of even men in their 80s being sent into prison for nothing more than carrying a picture of the Dalai Lama. It's now a crime in in China, Tibet at the moment. If you just call up your relatives, if a Tibetan calls up his relatives in San Francisco and tells them what's happening in Tibet, he can be thrown into prison for 6 years just for describing objectively what's happening there. So things are very, very dark and difficult.
That was Pico Iyer, well-known journalist, novelist, and writer of half a dozen books, including The Global Soul. We were talking about his most recent book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama, which has just come out in paperback in time for the 50th anniversary of the Chinese occupation, or the reoccupation of Tibet, and the Dalai Lama's flight to India. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 o'clock, till Jimmy Accardi takes over. A couple of weeks ago, a fellow I've known for years, but never really well, handed me two books. One was really, really skinny. The other was really, really thick. The man is Belden Johnson, who probably many people in Nevada County know as a marriage counselor, also as a poet. I know he has performed in a number of readings around here. I didn't know that he was also a novelist, and now I do. I've been reading Fathers and Teachers, his new novel, with a lot of enjoyment. Because it's shorter, I've gotten more of his skinny book, which was Snake Blossoms, Fabulations by Belden, which came out in 1976. And I noticed that the biographical sketch in the very back, you say he is presently remodeling a nursery school, caring for 12 children, finishing a novel, and selling this book. I hear that the sale of the book went very well.
Yeah, that particular book, because of its graphic cover, sold out of Cody's faster than any book of poetry, I hear.
But the novel apparently has taken another 33 years.
Well, I'm a slow writer.
And a very deliberate one.
Well, I'm not sure in a Thoreauvian way, if it would be deliberate, but it does take me time to do what I need to do in terms of writing.
And I did notice that the book of poems, Snake Blossoms, has at least a half a dozen styles, poetic styles, maybe more, that you vary how you write according to what you're writing about and probably what effect you want to make. There are prose passages, there are very short free verse, there's longer narratives, there's even a few rhyme sections.
Yeah, my belief is that form follows function, that and rather than being wedded to a particular format, what I'm interested in doing is trying to find the particular form that best expresses whatever the content of that piece is.
For Fathers and Teachers, for the novel, though, you've decided to go with a straight narrative, very detailed, lovingly detailed, I would say, and very slow-paced. It's the sort of thing that sort of draws you in, and you could live in this book for half a week or more, maybe a week or two if you wanted to savor it.
Yeah, it's an old-fashioned story that develops very slowly. There's not a lot of action scenes or graphic sex in it, because it's basically concerned with the development of a young boy and how he comes into his own growth and manhood over a period of years.
And so to do that, you have to describe his physical environment and his social environment, and you do that with great, great care.
Well, thank you. I wanted to do that. It looks to me like we are all extensions of the spirit of place, and that the place in which we are rooted informs who we are and who we become.
I heard you read several sections from this 2 days ago, and you said that you had worked on this for 20 years. So is this the novel you were working on when you published Snake Blossoms, or do you have others?
No, I have five other novels, and I was working on a different novel at that time. Snake Blossoms was published in Berkeley by the Berkeley Poets Press, and I think the novel that I was working on then was a Berkeley novel about living in and loving in Berkeley during the 70s.
And you gave that up in favor of, oh, I guess it's about 7 years from roughly the end of a few years after the end of World War II into the early 50s in the region pretty close to Washington, the rural, then very rural region close to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, Fathers and Teachers is set in rural Virginia during the post-war era when segregation is still happening and goes up through 1955, just after the Brown versus Topeka decision, which made integration the law of the land. And so the relationship of the races is an important part of this book.
Why did you decide to concentrate on, of the five novels you've worked on, why is this what the one you finished first? Is it the most personal, or?
Well, I think it is, Eric. It is close to my heart. But also I got a lot of encouragement about this book, including from my wife Yashi, who thought really, really wanted to see it published. She thought it was really wonderful. And I have plenty of other novels in the pipe that are ready to go. It's just a question of finding the right publisher for them.
And of course, a novel takes much longer. I know you've continued to write poetry and you continue to read around. Do you actually, in the biographical description that you gave me for Fathers and Teachers, you describe yourself as a marriage counselor and poet. You think of those as being your two primary occupations, perhaps?
No, I really think of myself, my primary occupation is being a human being. That takes a lot of work. And then a loving partner and a father. I think that those are much more important for me than the métiers.
And as a father, you've been a surrogate father for hundreds of children around here.
Yeah, I've had the privilege of coaching a lot of kids in this area who are now adults. It's really wonderful to watch them grow up and go out into life.
How did you decide you wanted to be this sort of human?
Well, I think there are a lot of different places along the road. I was just remembering this morning, actually, that it was when I was 11 and I just read Treasure Island that I decided I was a writer. And I decided that because the feeling that I had from reading Robert Louis Stevenson's book was so profound in my body that I went, wow, that is magic, to be able to communicate a feeling like that from one human being to another. That's what I want to do when I grow up. And I started writing right then. I wrote a story and sent it off to Boys Life. And they sent me back a very lovingly crafted rejection.
My question actually was not so much as what made you decide to be this kind of person, of human. You said that's your main occupation, and you clearly take your relationship with other people very seriously, as well as your relationship to words.
And I'm not sure I'm following. There's another question in there. There's
okay. I was probably a leading question. I'm not. I know that Fathers and Teachers is somewhat autobiographical. I know that there's a lot of autobiography in the poems in Snake Blossoms, and I noticed that there's some of the same themes, and I've read one essay on primal religion you wrote that has some of the same themes too, and they seem to involve rather harsh parents and rather loving parents, and you seem to have had the choice when you were young. You experienced both.
Yeah, I had a strict authoritarian father, and who was also very loving in his own way. And one of the ways that he was that he really sponsored my relationships with other men when he realized that he and I had difficulty communicating. And he helped me become fathered by a variety of the people in the town in which I grew up, which is very similar to the one in Fathers and Teachers, which is called Pohick, Virginia. And I was really fortunate, for instance, to have a very loving grandfather who, as I say through Billy's eyes in the book, when Billy thinks of the Old Testament God, he thinks of his father, and when he thinks of the New Testament God, he thinks of his grandfather. The difference between the God of wrath and the God of love. And that, yeah, I received a lot of different inputs in my own early life.
The family in the novel, let us say, they moved from the north to this very small town outside of Washington, D.C., in rural Virginia, a town of 200 people, with full of eccentric characters, but also full of very traditional attitudes about religion, race, politics, and so on. Why did, well, you could ask either one. Why did your family move to such a place, or why did Billy's family move to such a place?
Well, I'm not totally sure about which is which, but I know that one of the loving things my own father did was to, he was working in Washington, D.C., in the government. And he wanted his children to grow up in a rural community. And so he drove an hour each way every day of the week so that we could grow up in a small town on a little farm and have the virtues of that, which are, of course, many of which are also present in our own community here in Nevada City.
But of course, he must have realized that that would make him more absent from his children.
It was a trade-off. He lost 2 hours a day with his children, and he provided us with a really magical environment. And as a young boy, I was happy that he was gone a couple more hours a day.
Do you want to read a section from the book?
I'd love to. This comes from a chapter in the second section. The second section is called The Education of Billy Wilson. And the chapter is called The Magic Locker. It rained hard all the next day, the big raindrops beating a staccato on the roof and knocking many of the leaves from the maples to the ground, where they lay like wounded birds on the thirsty grass. Billy waited for lightning but was disappointed. There wasn't even thunder. When he grew bored with watching the weather and reading, he went upstairs, wandering from room to room, carrying his teddy bears. At the foot of his parents' bed sat a black foot locker in which nestled a host of souvenirs that Dad had brought back from the war. Though the foot locker was not locked, there was a special ritual to entering it. It was no good if the sun was streaming in the windows. It must be raining, or at least cloudy. Mom must be busy elsewhere. After closing the bedroom door quietly behind him, Billy would pass his hands thrice over the top of the footlocker, gently touching the scarred black surface until he felt tickling his palms, the signals coming from the waking spirit within. Closing his eyes, he would slowly lift the top so the spirit could escape to go dance upon the clouds. Then the footlocker was all his. The clothing on top was camouflage. It was only ordinary army officer's clothing, though it made a soft bed for the spirit to sleep on. The imprint of his form still lingered on Dad's beribboned jacket as though a Bob White had nested there. Beneath the clothes were the treasures. There was a helmet which had protected the head of an officer in the SS, the double lightning streaked gray against a black square on each side. Billy had once asked his father if he had killed the SS officer to get his helmet, and was disappointed to hear that Dad had bought it for 2 marks from a white-haired grandmother who needed something to eat. Donning the helmet and fastening the leather chin strap, Billy took Dad's black briar pipe by the bowl for a pistol and hunted Nazis under the bed and in the closet. When he dealt the Nazis their final solution for that day, he dug further into the footlocker. The tarnished drinking cup from the British pub became a grail, from which he gave communion to his teddy bears while chanting from a thin volume entitled Egil's Saga. The German admiral's ivory-handled short sword made him a knight of the Round Table. Surveying the souvenirs strewn on his parents' bedroom floor, he studied 2 objects familiar to his games which puzzled him. There was a small card on which was painted a woman with blonde hair to her waist, who was attaching her dark stockings to a lacy garter belt. Examining this card, Billy was troubled by the strange feelings within him. First, the picture drew him to it. He kissed the woman, but that was unsatisfactory, and then he wanted to tear the card up. But he could not, and not only because he knew his father would notice it missing. There was to the card a mystery that seemed beyond him. He thrust the card aside, but not too far, and face up, so that he could glance at it, if he wished. Having done so, he picked up the other object. It was a ridged rubber circle with 3 tiny yellow feathers in the center. It made him think of a donut, except with the middle, where the hole should be. Pushing his finger into the middle, directly behind the feathers, he pulled the ridges down over it. They unrolled. Seizing the object by the end beside the feathers and unrolling it completely, he held it up to the light. It was a dragon's tail. Pumpy, his one-eyed teddy bear, would be the dragon. He slipped the tail over Pumpy's left leg and trailed it out full length behind him. Pumpy looked ferocious. Billy felt a delightful little tremor of fear. He placed the painted woman in front of the dragon and the drinking cup behind him. Arming himself by slipping into an army shirt that dangled to the floor, his coat of mail, he stuck the black briar into the breast pocket that was by his waist. This was his mace, since knights didn't carry pistols. Dad's officer's hat, the leather strap down off the visor, made an excellent shield. With the German admiral's short sword in his right hand, he was ready. But before he sallied forth to fight the dragon and save the maiden in distress, he must secure the protection of the Almighty. Fufu, the fat teddy, would read the mass. Placing the occult pages of the saga in Fufu's ample lap, and kneeling before him, the short sword held up by the blade like a cross, Billy bowed his head. Oh, Father God Almighty, protect him in this his hour of grace, that is going forth to seek the Holy Grail and save the damsel from the dragon Pompidour Gaza, who is scaring everybody in the village and eating their children and maidens and breathing smoke and fire. Oh, Father, be kind unto him and help him in every way, for he is good and strong and brave and a good knight. Crossing himself, he arose, tightened the straps of shield and helm, flourished his sword, and set off on the quest. His horse was white with a flowing silver mane. He pranced through the streets with lashing hooves click-clacking on the cobblestones. Everyone came out to watch them as they passed. They cheered because the knight was going to save them from the dragon and rescue the beautiful maiden who was about to be eaten alive. Women wept. Men knelt by the roadside, children threw their hats into the air. Sir William held his head high and rode on into the wild country beyond the village where briars tore at him and goshawks circled above. The way became rocky and steep. All round him lay the bleached bones of the dragon's victims. And then he saw it, loathsome, scaly and putrid, snorting fire and vomiting smoke, its long yellow tail with the scorpion sting circling snake-like behind. The maiden screamed for help. Her golden hair hung in disarray to her waist. Her clothes hung in tatters, torn by cruel claws. Her comely face beseeched him. Raising his sword, he spurred his steed forward into the thundering charge. The dragon bellowed in rage. The maiden gasped. Smoke and fire enclosed them. He felt his horse moving strong beneath him, felt the heat, smelt the smoke, and then his good sword crashed through the scales into the dragon's belly. The horse reared. The howling dragon groveled. The maiden threw herself into her knight's arms. Smiling, he raised his visor. She covered his face with kisses. Her arms held him. She smelled of roses and violets.
Very nice.
Thank you.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Belden Johnson about his new novel, Fathers and Teachers. He just read a section from it. If people want the book, how do they get it?
Well, I understand that it's at Booktown for a couple more days. And Stacy has it at Harmony Books. You can also order it online from Amazon.
Who is actually the publisher, which I thought was a very interesting...
Yes, Amazon has subsidiaries that that publish books in conjunction with them.
So now, of the other five novels you have going, where do they stand?
Well, there's one that I've been working on actually since I was in college. And I tried to write it for my senior thesis, but in its wisdom, the Department of History and Literature said that a historical novel would not serve as that because they wouldn't know how to grade it. That's a direct quote from Harvard. That novel, I'd written about 100 pages of it, and then Cold Mountain came out, which tells precisely the same story, but much better written than I could ever do. So I have to go back and find another way to do that one.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I'm working on a nonfiction book on called The Lover's Guidebook, Tools for Building the Path of Relationship, which I hope is going to be helpful for us all, myself included.
And how far is that from completion?
I'm hoping to finish and publish that this year.
So you may come back.
I would be delighted to.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us. We're just about out of time now. I see Jimmy Icardi lurking like a dragon in the background.
And does he have a long tail?
I don't think so, and we have no swords, however. No shields.
More to the point.
More to the point. So we are going to leave here, and pretty soon you're going to hear Jimmy Icardi. Jimmy Icardi always says that he thinks this music sounds like a depressive Pink Panther.